This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
Using this eye-opening to stretch the imagination and are the product of very personal visions. Each of the artists we'll meet on this tour use more ingenuity and creativity than dollars to create their dream homes. The tour departs from the world-famous Orange Show promptly at 12:30 p.m. and returns at 6:30 p.m. Seating is limited, so call the Orange Show at 713-926-6368 to reserve your spot on this afternoon art adventure today. This is KPFT Houston.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT in Houston. And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbi, gay, and transgender identity. This is Queer Voices.
And it's the August 7th edition of Queer Voices. Tonight on our show, David Elliott will be calling from Washington, and he will be doing the Inside the Beltway and Beyond report. Allison Beckett, artist and writer of Dykes to Watch Out For, will be interviewed by Deborah Bell, and she's got, and our guest contributor, Pokey Anderson. Wow, that's great. About Fun Home. This was a great interview that was done on Weekend Sunday Edition, but I'm sure Pokey's going to do even better. Joan Devlin will be calling to discuss a book about gay marriage, for better or worse, what we've learned from the evidence. All that's coming up on this edition of This Way Out, including This Way Out. This is Jack Falinski.
And Jennifer Renee.
I'm Deborah Bell.
And I'm Glenn Holt.
And we do have a sad note to start out the show with today. Our good friend Brenda Thomas has passed away.
Right, and we'll be having some commentary about that later in the program. Yeah.
So all that's coming up, but first we have a piece of music before we talk to David Elliott. Where the Boys Are with Neil Sedaka. J.D. is not with us this evening, so I guess I have to announce the songs.
Or well, I guess you will.
I guess
yes.
So. With us this evening, of course, on the first Monday of every month, is David Elliott calling in from Washington.
Our main man, our man inside the Beltway.
David?
Well, good evening to you, Jack, and good evening to you, Deb. How are y'all tonight? And hello, Queer Voices.
I guess they didn't send you to the ranch in Crawford, huh?
Well, you know, they didn't. You know, I was a little bit busy with my work in D.C., and I just couldn't quite make it down there for the quote-unquote vacation.
Oh, okay.
But there's lots of things going on politically, and I think you have some inside scoop to share with us on Queer Voices.
Well, indeed, Deb and Jack, I want to make tonight my first of four predictions leading into the November election. We are now, of course, only 92 days away from Election Day. That's 13 weeks and one day.
Actually, we've got one tomorrow. Do you have a prediction on that one?
Well, I do, and I'm going to get to that, Jack.
Okay.
Indeed. Before I make my prediction that, you know, my kind of big one for tonight, I do want to bring you breaking news out of Washington, D.C. We have three major breaking news stories to report to you tonight, and I'm going to take these one by one. We're going to give each about maybe 30, 45 seconds. First off, the U.S. Supreme Court late this afternoon denied an effort by the Republican Party of Texas to take former Congressman Tom DeLay's name off of the November ballot. What this means for many listeners who are listening to the program tonight is that Tom DeLay, who doesn't want to run for re-election, who won his primary but then decided that he could not win the general election because of all of the various controversies that have been going on, what it means is that he is not going to be able to remove his name. It's going to be Tom DeLay on the ballot as the Republican nominee and former Congressman Democrat Nick Lamson as a Democratic nominee. And we can probably pretty much put this one in the Democratic pickup column. That is huge news, very significant news. The legal fight is over. Tom DeLay stays on the ballot. Now, second breaking news story out of Washington, D.C. this evening. Another congressman, another Republican congressman, Bob Ney, out of Ohio, has dropped his reelection bid. He is removing his name from the ballot. This time he can do that because the primary election hasn't been held yet. He is another person who was caught up in the Jack Abramoff scandal. This likely will be another Democratic pickup. Big news out of Ohio. And finally, and Jack, you alluded to this, we are waiting for the polls to open about 11 hours from now in the state of Connecticut, where challenger Ned Lamont will be defeating, and yes, you heard that right, will be defeating incumbent Democratic Senator
Joe Lieberman.
Lieberman. I was stretching for that first name. The question is not how the primary election is going to come out tomorrow. We know from every single indicator, from every single poll that has been taken, that Lamont is going to defeat Lieberman. What we don't know is whether Lieberman is going to follow through on his threat to run as an independent candidate in the November election. And here's my prediction, folks. If Lamont beats Lieberman greater than 55% to 45%, I think Lieberman is going to step down.
Really?
I don't think he'll run. I think the Democrats will be able to talk him out of it. If it's closer than that, I think he'll stay in there. But I don't think it's going to be closer than that. I'm looking at an outcome probably of 57% for Lamont, 43% for Lieberman.
David, what do you account for this downfall of Lieberman to have someone who's a newcomer or at least has not been previously elected into this position to come and take a veteran out like this? And, you know, what's going on? Is it party issues? Is it style?
Deb, it's two things. First and foremost, it's the war in Iraq. Americans are angry. Americans don't understand why we went over there, why we're still there, what the outcome is going to be. We've all seen the headlines. The country seems to be devolving into civil war. Nobody wants that. But why?
Except the Iraqis.
Well,
apparently, you know, the Iraqis want it.
Well, you know, I'm sure some of the extremes in various camps do, but, you know, I'm sure the ones with the guns do.
You're right.
The second reason, Deb, is there is, I think, a tendency among both Democrats and the American public writ large that people are not standing up to this administration, and both Democrats and polling shows, independents, therefore the American public writ large, are looking for people, anyone, anywhere, who will stand up and say, wait a minute, we don't like the way things are going. You know, 2 weeks ago, a Pew Research poll came out showing that only 29% of the American public thinks our country is on the right track. 29%. How awful is that?
It's pretty bad.
Yeah.
I know. I don't feel like we're on the right track. And we did have a vigil here in Houston earlier this evening at the Rothko Chapel calling for an immediate ceasefire among the Palestinians in Lebanon. And that's a growing concern.
Isn't that just ludicrous the way this government says, oh, give them a week or give them 2 weeks to continue a war? Unbelievable.
A lot of things about this government are ludicrous. Now, the other question, which is one that people keep asking me, David, and I just don't know how to answer them for sure. What I usually say is, delay cannot win this election because he's not eligible any longer because he's a resident of another state. Because they keep saying, but what if he really gets more votes than Lampson if he's on the ballot?
Oh no. Let us not disabuse ourselves of this notion. Delay definitely can win. If he were to get the most votes on November 6th, he wins the election. However, it ain't going to happen.
Okay. David has predicted. He has spoken.
It's done. You know, folks, DeLay and his top political consultants, they did a massive amount of polling before they decided to make the request to take DeLay's name off of the ballot after he had won the Republican primary. They made the determination that DeLay could not get reelected. And that was as if we had a scenario where for the last 2 months, instead of fighting to get his name off the ballot, DeLay had been campaigning aggressively. Well, guess what? Nick Lampson has been raising money and has been campaigning aggressively. DeLay has not been doing anything. This race is over. Now, I have to caution you that in 2 years, the Republicans will probably win the seat back. It's a Republican seat. It's just that this year, as the Democrats look at the math that takes them to the 15 seats they need to win to capture Congress, this is a Democratic pickup. And Deb and Jack, if I may, this leads to my prediction for this month, okay?
We're listening.
Democrats need to pick up 15 seats. Well, if you can do three things, if you can A, read political polling data, if you can B, read campaign finance reports, and if you can C, count to 15.
Well,
the only conclusion you can reach is that we are going to get to 15, and in fact, I am predicting a Democratic pickup in the U.S. House of Representatives this November of 30 to 35 seats.
Now, does this also include the voting machines?
Well, you know, a lot has been made of the Diebold, I call them Diebold, electronic voting machines. I am as cynical as the next person, but I will not go on the air and be so cynical as to say that our votes do not matter, that our votes will not be counted. I do expect our votes to be counted, and I expect our votes to be counted accurately, and I believe that on Election Day, that will happen.
Okay.
Well, we're going to have you talk with Pokey Anderson, who's going to be on later tonight for on a different subject, about the whole issue of the voting machines and how accurate they may or may not be. But is there anything else you want to leave us with, David, before we close out from the Inside the Beltway and Beyond report?
Deb and Jack, that's about it. You know, just to look for a 30 to 35 seat pickup for Democrats in the U.S. House of Representatives this November. It does now look like the Democrats are going to be recapturing the House of Representatives, which they lost 12 years ago, November 1994.
Do we have any hopes for Senate pickups?
Well, you know, Deb, I was going to come on and talk about that next month.
Okay.
It's going to be really, really close.
Okay.
Can you give us a hint, maybe a tease?
Yes,
oh, Jennifer,
I
you always love to be teased.
I like to be teased.
Democrats would need to pick up 6 seats in order to capture the U.S. Senate. Right now, I have the Democrats capturing between 4 and 7 seats.
So there's an outside chance.
All
it
right.
It could go either way. We have to look at how campaigns, particularly in Arizona and Nevada, progress in the next month. And we got to get some more polling numbers.
And what about Texas?
You know, I know
didn't mean
the
to
Democrats
you on that
are running an aggressive campaign in Texas, and God bless them.
So we're trying.
We'll stay tuned for that for next month on when David joins us the first Monday of the month.
That'll be Labor Day.
Yeah, all right. And we'll be here, as we usually are on the Monday.
We're here all the time. And David, what do you do for your day job?
Well, Jack, for my day job, I'm the communications director for the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. You can see us on the web at www.ncadp.org. Again, that's ncadp.org.
David, thank you. David Elliott joins us on the first Monday of every month to give us a sort of a viewpoint of what's going on in Washington. You're listening to Queer Voices.
this hype identifies a homotype, be it to me, it's sex and heterodoxy. The gay wave moves across the sea, hero there, Miss Liberty. Betty Booth is hot, she's out in the cold. Greenwich Village, Bloomsbury, gays in my society. Harlem Nights, Chicago fights, Leopold and Loeb. Pride, pride, gotta have pride. Been around too long to keep it inside. Pride, can't sit back and watch from the side. Pride is power and power is pride. It's time to celebrate all the colors of the rainbow. Get out into the streets, follow the tide. Hits the Broadway stage with Beats and Cadmus, all the rage and the well of loneliness appears on the stands. Russian red lights, crystal knife, Adolf shows Olympic might. Put on your pink triangles and put up your hands. A-bomb, 50s Keen, McKinsey, shake the patch, you'll see James Dean, Mattachine, Doris Day and Harry Gay. Donald Webster, Corey Rice, Joe McCarthy, picks the fight. J. Edgar Roy, for shame on you, what else do you plan to do? Jorgensen's reborn, daughters of Belitis form, and we have our naked lunch in Giovanni's room. Marilyn, the picnic scene, Jackie's in her Cassini, Vatican II, and something's coming soon. Summer 1969, the heat is rising all the time, and over the rainbow, Judy Garland sleeps. Stonewall Bar, men in blue, heads from broken bottles flew out of the bars and into the streets. Pride, pride, gotta have pride. Been around too long to keep it inside. Pride, can't sit back and watch from the side. Pride is power and power is pride. It's time to celebrate all the colors of the rainbow. Get out into the streets, follow the tide. Boys in the band play, Bette Midler sang those bathhouse days. Lance Loud, Gay and Proud, Oscar Wilde bookstore, Sister George Doonesbury, Tales of the City, Anita Bryant, Village People, Studio 54, Harvey Milk, Rough Trade, Aaron Fritz, Prom Day, Creed, Torchon Trilogy, Boy George, NG, MHC, HIV identified, Rock Hudson, Liberace died, Reagan finally says the word, Bowers versus Harvard's heard. Frank, AIDS, Quilt, Act Up, Randy Schultz, Queer Nation, Maple Floor, Phase ET, Amendment 2, Cracker Barrel, Don't Ask, Don't Tell, HX, Cyber Sex, March on DC, Greg Louganis, Selton, John, George Michael, what is going on? Lilith Fair, Rowdy Girls, Spend a Day at Disney World, Coonan and Scare, the Mix, the Case, Ian, Ellen, Will and Grace, Matthew Shepard, God bless you, what else can we look forward to? Pride, pride, gotta have pride. We've been around too long to keep it inside. Pride, can't sit back and watch from the side. Pride is power and power is pride. It's time to celebrate all the colors of the rainbow. Get out into the streets and follow the tide. Pride, gotta have pride. We've been around too long to keep it inside. Pride, can't sit back and watch from the side. Pride is power and power is pride. It's time to celebrate all the colors of the rainbow. Get out into the streets, follow the tide. Pride.
John Gilbert Levitt from the year 2000, that was Pride. And before that, Joe Jackson with a song called Real Men from his album Night and Day from 1982. This is Queer Voices.
And this is Deborah Bell.
And Jennifer Renee.
And we're back in the studio with no stranger to this studio, to KPFT, and who was, I have to admit, she was here, but she forgot something, so she had to run and get it, so she came back. But I was going to say Pokey was really living up to her name, because we thought, is she going to make it or what?
Nah, I was early.
But we had some collaboration over the fact that we had this wonderful new book out by Alison Bechtel, and Pokey asked, could she possibly do this interview? And knowing that she had some history with our guest, I said, sounds good to me. So take it away, Pokey.
Thank you, Deborah. Thanks for the opportunity to be a guest here on a gay, lesbian, bisexual, trans show rather than my boring old news show, which is The Monitor on Sunday night, where we talk about war and peace and stuff. So I'm glad to be here, and I think I get to welcome Allison. Hi, Allison.
Hi, Pokey.
It's great to hear your voice.
Great to hear yours. So we have history, huh?
Well, not nearly enough, Allison.
I was wanting to know about that history.
All right, Jennifer.
Later, after
those.
The show.
Okay, there's special tickets for that.
Yeah, right.
And your show is great. Your show is one of the best shows on the radio.
Oh, you can keep talking. I'm gonna let you keep talking.
It's gonna be a love fest. I can tell.
Yeah, really.
Starting out that way.
All right.
Love the monitor.
Well. So Allison is this, if you need an introduction to her, okay, I'll give you a little one, but really, you know, you shouldn't even be listening to this show if you need an introduction to Allison Bechtel. She has done 12 in her collection of comic books, cartoon books, Dykes to Watch Out For. She's got a fistful of Lambda Literary Awards. The series has been called one of the greatest hits of the 20th century by Utney Reader. You've taken a break from that to do, well, sort of a break, not really, to do Fun Home, and we'll get to that in just a sec. But looking at your Dykes to Watch Out For series, is there any special issue that you've touched on, whether macro like war and politics or personal issues like housemate squabbles, infidelity, breastfeeding, feminist bookstores going out of business, anything that just is your, you know, like the most favorite or the most incendiary or anything that just comes to mind?
Well, you know, my most favorite thing is making parallels between the people's intimate personal lives and the broader political sphere. I can't think of any great examples right now, but that's what I'm always trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
That's what excites me.
Great. And to do this book, how did you manage to keep up with your strip as well?
Oh, man, it was really hard. I just worked constantly, like really 12 hours a day for 7 years.
Wow. I did a little of my own archive search in preparation for this, and I found the flyer for when you first came to Houston as a, you know, famous cartoonist in 1990 and did a show at a slideshow at Treebeards. And
yeah.
It's got this cute little thing on the side with Mo saying, a slideshow, hold me back. So I have to say, you know, I remember that very well. And I remember that you struck me as one of the shyest people we had ever invited to do something public like that. So now you're doing this incredibly personal expose of your life and your family's life. Has anything changed, or what happened?
That's a very good question. I don't know. Somehow this urge to, like, reveal my most intimate secrets to large numbers of anonymous people coexists with my incredible shyness. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Yeah.
I think I have some kind of intimacy disorder. You know, like, it's easier to say all this stuff to strangers than to actually have intimate relationships with, like, one other person.
Well, of course, you know, what with blogs and everything, I think there's a lot of people doing that.
Yeah.
They'll tell the whole world things, but maybe it's too much information.
Although when Allison was here a number of years ago for the Texas Lesbian Conference, she had come out of her shell a little bit and it was much more poised and much more comfortable with speaking to an audience. But certainly the anonymity of doing a book, rather than talking about it with the people you're most intimate with, which it really was something not talked about in the family, right?
The material that my book is about?
Right.
Yeah, we didn't talk about that so much.
and this was a coming out in yet another way for you and on behalf of your other family members.
Coming out on behalf of my father? Is that what you mean?
No, well, just coming out with the whole secrets of the family.
Yeah. Well,
of telling, they're being allowed to tell their story. I noticed the book was dedicated to your mother and brothers.
Well, it's not their story. I think they would all be very careful to tell you that. This is my version of events and has, you know, little or no bearing on the way they see our family history.
And speaking of versions, the issue of truth and verity comes up quite early. You started keeping a journal at 10, and then not too long after, I guess, you started putting "I think" under just about every entry. You know,
yes.
Went to the movie. I think.
And a little obsessive compulsive phase.
Yeah, but to do this book, you went back and looked at diaries, your father's letters, old date books, family albums, and used a lot of that, you know, primary material just as a historian would. A New York Times reviewer actually visited your town and noted that your drawing of the cemetery was accurate right down to the almost unnoticeable radio tower.
That's what happens when you put maps in your book. People feel compelled to follow them.
So talk a little bit about truth and how you relate to truth now in terms of this book.
Well, I think, you know, the act of doing this book has sort of changed my perception of truth. I mean, I was originally motivated by wanting to tell the true story of my father. I felt like people didn't know. I mean, should we, like, recap a little bit of the story for people?
Yeah, let's do that. Go ahead.
The book is about, it's a memoir about my closeted gay or possibly bisexual father. I found out about him when I blithely came out to my parents when I was 19. I thought, you know, this is really great. I'm a lesbian. I figured everything out. I told them, and it just sort of started this implosion of our family. I found out, eventually, my mother told me that my dad had had affairs with other men. And very shortly after that, my dad died in a rather suspicious manner. Okay. He was hit by a truck, mm-hmm. and we pretty much assumed it was suicide. So it was a very crazy, confusing, intense time of my life. You know, this, you know, a period of several months in which I came out, found this news out about my dad, and my dad died. So the book is a way of, like, trying to sort that out for myself many years later.
And it took you 20 years to attack it.
Yes. Well, it took a long time to feel like I was even able to tell it, to reveal these secrets. You know, at first I didn't think I ever could tell it. But somewhere along the line, I changed my mind. You know, the atmosphere, the political and social and cultural atmosphere around sexuality changed. It felt like it wasn't such a, you know, taboo thing to reveal. And so I eventually felt like I really wanted to tell the story. What to me was the true story. But now, I did. I feel like I told my version of the story as best I could, but really, it's just my version. My mother's version would be utterly different, and so would my brother's.
Well, one of the odd things about, you know, you have, everybody's childhood is unique, but yours is obviously unique, what with your father and your father being a part-time funeral home director. You know, as you said, sometimes you thought you were in an episode of The Addams Family. But both your parents actually were skilled at illusion. You know, your father was apparently, you know, a heterosexual father. And also he managed to take dead people and make them look alive.
Yes.
And your mother was an actress in the community.
Yes.
And so here you are trying to tell the truth.
Very good point. Also, my dad was totally obsessed with interior decoration and restoring our old Gothic Revival house. You know, he was just consumed with appearances in every way. Our family, the house.
And you had to dust all that stuff.
God. Yes, I spent my childhood dusting. And then I spent my adulthood drawing pictures of all the little baubles and furniture that I spent my childhood dusting.
At least you didn't have to dust the pictures. So talk a little about the craft involved in this. You know, you probably don't remember, but many years ago I asked you to take a picture that was really funny of my girlfriend who had fallen asleep with a puppy next to her. And you said, well, I really can't do realistic drawings. But you did it anyway, and it looked great. So now, I mean, you'd have to say, yeah, I can do realistic drawing and an incredible nuance.
Well, I can fake it anyway.
Yeah, Allison.
I don't know. I'm not really a natural. Well, I don't know. In some ways, I am good at drawing it, I do have a natural talent for it. But in other ways, I'm not really that great. I just work really hard. I take lots of reference photos. I labor over these images a long time, like many generations of sketches before I do the final inked version. I'm trying to get more confident and quicker, but it's a pretty painstaking process for me. That's why it took me 7 years to write this book.
Yeah. Any ideas? The book's been really well received. I mean, some of the quotes are just, you know, great, like Chip Kidd on the back of the book. Stupendous. The details, visual and verbal, emotional and elusive, are devastatingly captured by an artist in total control of her craft. So now that you've done this, do you want to just take a break? Or do you think there'll be another graphic novel like this?
Oh, I really want to keep doing work like this. I mean, I want to keep doing a comic strip, but I definitely want to do another memoir, and I'm starting to work on one already.
Oh, and what will that cover? What do you want to say?
Relationships.
Ooh.
I don't know exactly yet. I'm working on my proposal. I'm trying to figure it out.
You know, you're going to get a lot of calls and emails if people want to be in those reference photos. So I'm talking with Allison Bechtel, the cartoonist who's done a jillion versions of Dykes to Watch Out For and also has a new book, a family tragic comic called Fun Home. So what's it been like to travel around the country being all shy and famous?
It's been really intense. Not an introvert's favorite activity. It's fun. What's not great about, like, getting flown around and staying in fancy hotels and meeting people who say nice things about you? It's been pretty good, but it really does sap my strength. You know, I'm very happy to have a break and be home now to, like, recover.
Mm-hmm. Well, you got to keep your strength up because these are strange times.
God.
Any comment on those strange times and how you deal with it?
Well, I guess I deal with it by doing my comic strip. Gives me like a, when you have a escape valve, a steam, what do you call it?
Letting off steam?
I don't know. It's kind of late here on the East Coast.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I deal with the insanity of this country by writing a comic strip that, you know, touches on the news as well as people's depraved personal lives and the intersections of those two things.
And the issue of, back to the issue of truth, I mean, like, people complained when you let the feminist bookstore Mad Women close. Do you ever get tempted to write a cartoon of things as you wish they were? So it would be true.
Rather than the reality, the stark reality of independent bookstores?
Well, no, just in general terms, not about that.
You know, I think in some ways the early years of my strip, it was more about a utopian community, or at least this utopian subculture, but, you know, there isn't much of a subculture left, and now my characters are all, you know, working at Borders, and they're cast out into the world, out into this world with no community left.
Talk about that. What's your perception of there's not much subculture left?
Well, I mean, I think that's true in terms of the gay and lesbian community, but I also think it's true in terms of the society at large that, we don't have any more gay and lesbian bookstores, so people are working at Borders. Everyone's working at chain stores. There's no more hardware stores. People are working at Home Depot. There's no local community left. Which is interesting, that the world in general is following the same course as the gay and lesbian subculture.
Mm-hmm. So as somebody who is, in many ways, I mean, I don't know, do you feel like you're relegated to the gay lesbian niche, as you know, in terms of who's going to see your stuff and buy your stuff? And if so, how are you affected by that kind of disappearance of the subculture?
I've been very concerned about for a long time. I mean, I have felt relegated to it, pigeonholed, ghettoized, all that. You know, and partly it's been my own doing, as well as something that, you know, a force that's affected me from outside. And I really didn't know for a while whether I was going to be able to keep doing this comic strip, whether there were going to be venues for it, whether I'd be able to make enough money from it. But somehow I'm pulling through, and I think I'm reaching more like progressive readers, mm-hmm. who aren't necessarily gay or lesbian, and who are really hungry to see their lives reflected in the same way that like lesbians in the early 80s were happy to see their life reflected in my comic strip.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I'm going to make a go of it.
Well, you've dealt with a lot of the changes in the community, too, such as trans acceptance, bisexuality, the babies that are suddenly everywhere.
Yeah, you want to change or die, right?
Right. And kind of the reality of lives that of the transitions that a lot of us have gone through, dealing with aging parents, dealing with breast cancer.
Try to keep up.
but you're presenting it in a truthful way and not shirking away from that this is what life is about. You know, people, when they think of comics, they always are thinking of them as ha-ha. And
yeah.
Even in the daily papers, there's no such thing as funny pages anymore. It's just a different style. Comic art is just a different style of writing.
I feel a responsibility to not have things tied up too neatly, to not oversimplify life. I think that oversimplification leads to fascism, personally. Mm-hmm. And so I try to always leave something sort of undigested, or I think there's something sort of difficult about my comic strip, and that I don't want to make it too accessible, or it will be evil.
Well, your book certainly left a whole lot of nuance and questions, and just I think when I wrote to you, I said it was kind of chewy because there's just so much going on. And I think, you know, maybe that's easier to do with pictures and text.
Absolutely. The thing that I love about telling stories visually is that you can do so many things at once.
Mm-hmm.
It's very frustrating to me to write in prose because you can really, unless you're very, very good, you can only say one thing at a time.
But there was two things about the book that struck me, and one, it seemed to be As you say, it's your story about your dad and your relationship with him, and also the effect that he had on your life and the influence that he had on you as to what you eventually, you know, with literature and the way you look at life.
Uh-huh.
And so I found that to be really what the book was about, was kind of the gifts that he gave you behind the scenes of this not seemingly very normal childhood. And the other issue that you vaguely touch on, but I think that is there, is the borderline pedophilia.
Uh-huh.
And you know, here you are, a child, seeing your dad relating to young men, some of them, I think, less than 18.
Yep. Well, I didn't have any idea what was going on when I was a kid.
Right.
There's a whole section of the story about the summer of 1969 when my dad and our male babysitter, who was 16 or 17, went to the beach. All of us went with my brothers. My mom did something else. And I just thought it was really great that Roy was coming to the beach with us.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't until I was an adult that I found out that my dad was carrying on with this kid.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I felt like I really needed to be honest about that, too. You mm-hmm. know, I'm not going to whitewash my dad.
But do you think, I mean, I don't know, when I was a kid, even before I probably knew the word anthropology, I always wanted to be a fly on the wall and go to other kids' houses and see what kind of differences there were, and, you know, see what really went on in their families, because I think, you know, everybody's is different. But I wonder how many families have secrets like that, maybe not that particular secret.
Judging by my email.
Really? Yeah. Tell me.
I'm just getting lots of messages from people who... It's funny because they'll say, oh, your family was just like mine, but then they go on to describe the family that was nothing like mine, but that they had a secret or...
Sounds like it would be a book in itself.
Really?
The true confessions.
Really? Well, you know, I was thinking about the idea that if your dad had grown up and... if gay liberation had been a few decades earlier, he might not have married your mom. And then where would you be?
Exactly. It's very hard for me to imagine what would have happened if he had come out.
Mm-hmm.
And what would have happened if he hadn't killed himself. Because, you know, I sort of follow that line of thinking, and I imagine that he might very well have died of AIDS, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He would have casual sex with people in the late 70s, and, you know, that's a very possible outcome, too. So it's hard to imagine his life any way except the way that it was somehow. I can't project into the future or into the past.
It was what it was, but, you know, I think... You know, I would have not been around either if abortions had been legal when I was born. So there's a lot of people on the planet, apparently about a quarter of the people, aren't really necessarily planned or whatever. So
that's a fascinating statistic.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
But so here we are.
Here we are. What are you going to do, you know? You got to deal with it. Here we are.
Yeah.
So, it's been a real pleasure to have Pokey Anderson set in on Queer Voices this evening as our special guest interviewer, and everyone here is a big fan of Alison Bechdel, so we're all thrilled to have her be on the air talking with us about Fun Home and Dykes to Watch Out For. Alison, is there anything that we didn't ask you that you think we should have?
I can never think of anything to say when people say that.
But let's tell them your website.
DykesToWatchOutFor.com.
Right, Dykes to Watch Out For. And you're coming to Austin sometime?
I am.
I believe it's in September.
It's in September.
And I'm hoping we'll get you here in Houston before you make it to Austin.
I'm going to be in Austin on the 24th of
right.
September.
Cool.
You can check my website for details on that.
Great.
Well, again, thank you for being with us on Queer Voices.
Thank you very much.
Good night.
Thanks, Alison.
upon their catalog. You got needs? Pick up the phone. Get an addition for your home. I see you smiling cause you know the number. Sykes Lumber. For what's in store. These women that don't need you, they got their own damn caulking and their own damn tools. But if you're a woman with a serious stare, get ready for a half price sale. With the right attitude, take the cashier home with you. In aisle 10, you'll find Pat. She knows what you want, she knows where it's at. And don't forget the store in Babylon. If you buy it there, they'll strap it on. Yes, oh, put on your flannel shirt, jump in your working van, hike up that skirt. Enter no man's land. Open up your heart, fill up that shopping cart. Don't wear no wedding band. Carol and the hair. In aisle 6, you'll find Chris. She just broke up with her ex-girlfriend, sis. She'll walk you through the whole damn store, then move you in with her U-Haul. I can hear our conversation.
1995, Jalen Ricks, Down at Stonewall, and before that, Steve Cohen with Dyke's Lumber from his year 2000 album, I Must Have Been Crazy. This is Queer Voices.
No, you.
Oh, me. Oh, okay. Well, we're sitting here pointing at one another.
Well, we want to say goodbye to our friend Brenda Thomas, who passed this weekend.
Well, there was a wonderful article that came out to sort of spelling out some of her accomplishments and all, and I was hoping we'd have time to read it all, but I won't have it at this segment. But, you know, one personal note, Brenda was instrumental when I came out. I remember Brenda when I first took my steps out of the closet in my high heels, as it were, on the streets of Houston, legitimately.
Being transgendered.
Being transgendered, yes. Oh, was that not obvious?
maybe not to all that don't know and love you as we do.
Oh, well, that's true. I'm sorry. I thought that had been clear. But anyway, you know, I went to one of the first support sessions, and she did, you know, she had the organization Transgenders Anonymous. And I remember going there the first time, very tentative, and hearing other people share their stories about being transgendered and living a life here in Houston. And, you know, it gave me hope and understanding that, you know, maybe I can live my life here too. And, you know, she was an inspiration to me. She was an inspiration to so many people.
What year was that, Jennifer?
That was 1994.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so she was one of the pioneers in the Houston community.
Absolutely.
Touched the lives of very many people, did lots of good work.
Countless people and lots of good work. She's been honored by many different organizations for her work, including the City of Houston, in both the transgendered outreach as well as AIDS health services.
In our closing segment, we'll talk more about Brenda Thomas. You know, last week we said goodbye to Jack Jackson. Now we've lost another one. And the good thing about that is a lot of us are getting older. And so that's...
Speak for yourself.
Older and better. And you are listening to Queer Voices here on KPFT in Houston and also in Galveston at 89.5 or 90.1 FM in Houston. We're also on the web at www.kpft.org. It's very important that you remember that you can download the show for 60 days. We're archived. So if you miss the program on Monday nights, you can hear it later.
And listen to it over and over again.
Yeah, download it.
Save it.
I'm sure they all do that, too.
I bet they do.
And you are listening to KPFT Houston. We're going to go to a bit of music, and we'll be back with This Way Out News Wrap.
I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
And I'm Sherry Lund.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending August 5th, 2006. The United Nations has criticized the United States for failing to protect gays and lesbians from discrimination and abuse. In a report released this week, the UN Human Rights Committee says the U.S. should ensure that federal and state laws address sexual orientation-related violence in its hate crime legislation and outlaw discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation in its federal and state employment legislation. A U.S. delegation appeared last month in Geneva to defend the country's record on lesbi, gay, and other human rights issues. During that appearance, Justice Department spokesperson Won Kim assured the U.N. committee that the U.S. maintains a profound and lasting commitment to equality. A statement by the U.S. delegation noted that some of the protections the U.N. report seeks, such as the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, have been proposed, but that measure has been a low-to-no priority issue in the Republican-controlled Congress. We are an open society, accustomed to robust public policy debate, the statement also claimed, adding that U.S. officials will be happy to examine the committee's views closely and draw any appropriate conclusions from them.
A number of vicious attacks in recent weeks underscore the need to combat anti-queer violence, not only in the U.S., but everywhere else. The decomposing remains of lesbian couple Candace Williams and Phoebe Myrie were found June 29th in a sealed septic pit behind the home they shared in Jamaica. An autopsy revealed that they died from multiple stab wounds. A police inspector told the Jamaica Star that a lead suspect had been identified, Williams' former partner, Dwayne Lewis. A relative told police that Lewis had encouraged Williams to experiment sexually with women, but his attitude changed when she slowly progressed from a bisexual to an outright lesbian, which led her to end the relationship with Lewis, according to the relative's statement. Human Rights Watch director Scott Long wrote Jamaican Minister of National Security Peter David Phillips this week, asking why, nearly a month after the bodies were discovered, Lewis has not been arrested or even questioned. As you know, Long wrote, Human Rights Watch has documented an atmosphere of homophobic intolerance and violence in Jamaica, and a pattern of indifference or reluctance to investigate such violence on the part of the police. Local advocates have expressed concerns about the level of commitment to identifying and prosecuting the murderer, he wrote.
Agence France-Presse reported this week that several teenagers have been arrested for a series of attacks on gay men in Tokyo. According to a police spokesperson, the teenagers, three in high school and one unemployed, believed that gay men are wealthy and unlikely to report such crimes to authorities. The boys allegedly injured a 34-year-old gay man in early July in Yumenoshima, a reclaimed waterfront area known as a gay hangout, robbing him of the equivalent of $180. The suspects also punched and kicked a 56-year-old gay man on the same day near the site, the spokesperson said, adding that police were investigating similar crimes in the area.
In Chile, a band of young neo-Nazis attacked a 27-year-old gay man and three friends in the affluent Santiago neighborhood of Las Condes on July 31st. According to a report in the Santiago Times, the assault is the latest in a string of neo-Nazi acts that have plagued the nation's capital in recent months, but until now were confined to more working-class parts of the city. The victim and his friends were walking down the street when they were approached by a group of skinheads in military garb who verbally taunted the man before physically assaulting him. He was taken to a nearby hospital with multiple bruises and cuts on his face, and officials there reported the crime to authorities. The victim was reluctant to do that because his family is unaware of his sexual orientation. In recent months, violence involving neo-Nazi youth gangs has escalated, concentrated in the southern Santiago borough of Puente Alto. The nation's media has reported that as many as 40 neo-Nazi groups operate out of that poor neighborhood. Antonio Leal, president of Chile's Chamber of Deputies, wants neo-Nazis banned in his country, adding that he would ask the government to put a hate crime law at the top of its agenda.
Police in New Mexico are handling the brutal beating of an 18-year-old gay man and his female friend under the U.S. state's new hate crimes law. People at a house party in Edgewood harassed the man because he's gay, police said. But when he tried to leave with his friend, the two were attacked. New Mexico State Police Lieutenant Rick Anglada told reporters that the young man was forced into a camper trailer at the residence, locked inside, and repeatedly beaten until the sun rose the next day. Prosecutor Donna Donyal said he suffered bleeding on the brain and a concussion, as well as facial lacerations and bruising, but has since been released from a hospital. Lieutenant Anglada said they've arrested two young men and are seeking a third in the case. He said the attackers told their victim that they were going to scare him straight.
Three suspected gang members face hate crime charges in the beating of patrons of a Riverside, California gay bar, the city's Press Enterprise newspaper reported this week. They've each been charged with three counts of assault and committing a hate crime. According to the report, the suspects walked up to the Menagerie Bar in downtown Riverside in the early morning hours of August 1st and began making anti-gay comments about people standing outside. After the people went back inside the bar, the men shattered a window with bricks and a rock. At that point, some bar customers went outside to confront them. Then, witness accounts vary, either the patrons tried to detain the men until police arrived, or patrons yelled back at them and the men attacked. Three Menagerie customers were injured in the melee. Jeffrey Owens, a 40-year-old gay man, died in June 2002 after being stabbed and beaten outside the same bar.
Six gay men were beaten with baseball bats and one was stabbed as they left the San Diego LGBT Pride Festival during the evening hours of July 29th. Police have arrested all three alleged young assailants, ranging in age from 18 to 24. They'll be charged with two counts each of attempted murder with a hate crime enhancement and two counts of assault with a deadly weapon. A fourth 16-year-old suspect was also taken into custody for being an accessory to the assaults and allegedly aiding the three attackers. Fred Sanz, openly gay press secretary to San Diego's Republican mayor Jerry Sanders, told reporters that one of the victims had his skull bashed in and he's going to have reconstructive surgery. The other five were treated at hospitals and released. At a July 31st press conference, Mayor Sanders himself said, "The attackers taunted the victims with anti-gay insults as they were beating them. This is the very definition of a hate crime." Sanders said police detectives worked on the case for 40 hours nonstop to find the alleged assailants.
More than 200 people, including the governor and attorney general of Maine, rallied on July 22nd in the city of Portland to support a lesbian couple whose home was rendered uninhabitable from vicious acts of vandalism. The suspects broke into the mobile home of Linda Botaw and Carrie Fuchs on the night of July 1st, destroying furniture and appliances, breaking windows, and spraying pesticides in several rooms. Valuables, including a box that contained Fuchs' father's ashes, were stolen. Their car was severely damaged and feces and urine were left in the car and the home. Anti-gay slurs were scrawled on the walls. The state attorney general's office has filed hate crime charges that also include burglary, theft, aggravated criminal mischief, and two counts of motor vehicle burglary against the suspects, two boys, aged 12 and 14.
But finally, a long simmering struggle over an LGBT pride proclamation by young queer activists in the city of Los Altos, California, has ended amicably. The city council approved a surprise motion last week to rescind a ban on proclamations regarding sexual orientation. City officials established the ban in February after the Gay Straight Alliance of Los Altos High School asked the council, for the third year in a row, to approve a proclamation declaring a citywide Gay Pride Day. Three of the five council members, including Mayor Ron Packard, supported the ban. The move brought unexpected and unwelcomed media attention to the Northern California Bay Area community of 28,000. During a news conference before last week's council meeting, dozens of business owners and residents called on city lawmakers to rescind the rule. "It's an embarrassment for many of us living and working in Los Altos," Peter Yesney told reporters, saying he spoke for 56 other business owners in the city who'd sign a petition supporting the ban's repeal. Mayor Packard then surprised critics by introducing a measure asking the council to consider lifting the ban. In an email to Gay Straight Alliance advisor Ruth Gibbs and shared with the San Jose Mercury News, Packard wrote that he was especially impressed by a presentation that students from the Gay Straight Alliance made during a July 11th meeting. The council passed a motion giving the mayor the sole power to issue whatever city proclamations he or she deems appropriate. The Gay Straight Alliance of Los Altos High School plans to ask for a Pride Day proclamation again next year.
That's News Wrap for the week ending August 5th, 2006. Written by Greg Corden and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Tanya King Perry.
And I'm Sherry Lund.
She had a Hollywood haircut. She wore black peg pants. Carried her cigarettes in her sleeve. She didn't much like to dance. And if that Bull Dyke Stone Butch Diesel Dagger woman doesn't mean very much to you today, sister, while you're walking on the path from your oppression, just remember who pointed the way. She had a bouffant hairdo. She used a lot of Maybelline. A woman loving woman, she loved her butch. There wasn't much she hadn't seen. And if that sweet femme flirty fox dolled up woman doesn't mean very much to you today, sister, while you're walking on the path from your oppression, just remember who pointed the way. Walking down the street holding hands, they were screamed at.
beaten as they left the bars. Fighting their oppression, never losing their direction. The frontline troops in a war of liberation. The founding mothers, she had a Hollywood haircut. She wore black peg pants. A strong, tough swagger and lesbian woman. Living like she did took a chance. And if those bull dyke, stone butch, diesel dagger women don't mean very much to you today, sister, while you're walking on the path from your oppression, just remember who pointed the way. Some of us act like we'd like to forget them. Are we too insecure to see the things that they could teach us if we'd only let them reach us? We're just different branches of a woman-loving tree. Same roots, you and me. She had a bouffant hairdo. She used a lot of Maybelline. A strong, tough swagger and lesbian woman living in a world that is mean. And if those sweet femme bull dyke women loving women don't mean very much to you today, sister, while you're walking on the path from your oppression, just remember the women who. Remember the women who. The way.
And we're just going to announce.
And from the album The Gates of Heaven, that was Dicapella with a song called Hollywood Haircut. This is Queer Voices. And now out to the fertile cornfields of Iowa, where Joan Devlin is sitting out there working her magic with, well, we have one guest for you.
That's right, William Eskridge. And finally, you know, this is an interview we had actually tried to do, I believe, on June 6th and had all kind of phone problems and this and that. So hopefully we will be able to do that tonight.
Joan, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Okay. William, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, guys, go ahead.
Yay. Hi, William. I'm sorry. I kind of got like this weird feedback. I was thinking, oh, no, not again with the phones. Well, William, could you talk to us about the book that you put together with Darren Spidal called Gay Marriage, For Better or Worse, What We've Learned from the Evidence?
Yes. The thesis of the book is particularly relevant today. Because of all the debate at the federal and the state level about same-sex marriage. As you know from the debate over the Marriage Protection Amendment, the main argument against same-sex marriage today is the conservative argument that granting full marriage rights to lesbian and gay couples will actually destroy marriage for straight couples. And so what Darren Spidale and I did in our book, Gay Marriage for Better or for Worse, was that we not only traced the history of the American debate, but we actually looked at the evidence that we have for Scandinavia, where same-sex unions have been recognized for the last 17 years. The first such law was in Denmark in 1989. And so our hypothesis was that if the conservatives were right that same-sex marriage in Denmark and some of the other Scandinavian countries ruined marriage as an institution, you ought to see an effect on the institution over the last 17 years in Denmark. And that was the premise of our research. And what we do in the book is we report the actual evidence from Scandinavia in both easy-to-understand graphs and then very detailed appendices. We talk about the stories of actual couples that have gotten married, and we gather the evidence that is available from those countries on the post same-sex marriage environment there.
Now, the Scandinavian experience has some sobering news for same-sex marriage supporters. What about that experience would suggest that same-sex marriage is not going to come to most of America anytime soon?
Well, we found several things in our Scandinavian research. The most dramatic finding was that in Denmark, for example, where marriage actually had been declining for about a generation before they adopted same-sex unions in 1989, the period after same-sex unions were adopted, the Danish evidence actually went exactly contrary to what the conservatives had been predicting. So marriage rates had been going down for a generation in Denmark before 89. After 89, they started going up. Divorce rates had been soaring in Denmark before 89. After 89, they declined. And the rates of children born outside of wedlock had been escalating dramatically in Denmark for the, say, 20 years before 89. They plateaued after 89 and then have shown small decreases in the new millennium. So that's the good news for same-sex marriage, that the conservative argument is a lavender herring. It's a false alarm. It's the kid crying wolf for the third time. The sobering news is that, unlike in the United States, same-sex marriage has come to the European countries, by and large, through legislation, and only after the population has become comfortable with recognizing same-sex unions, and sometimes under euphemistic labels. So, for example, in Scandinavia, marriage is not the term that they have been using. They've been calling them registered partnerships since 1989 in Denmark. Now, we're quite certain that same-sex marriage will come to Scandinavia, probably Sweden first in a few years, but it's been a very incremental process. That same-sex marriage does not come to a society overnight and simply based upon legitimate demands for equal treatment, but it's a long sort of critical struggle where you have to persuade ordinary folks, including skeptical folks at the ground level and across society before you're going to get any kind of formal state recognition.
William Eskridge, who is Stanley Kurtz, and how has he been using the data from Scandinavia to support his defense of marriage claims? Because you hear this guy a lot on right-wing radio, and I don't know that many of our audience would be familiar with him.
Well, you're quite right. You do hear a lot of him because he's a former researcher at the Hoover Institute. I believe he's located out of Washington, D.C. now. And he had done some preliminary studies, not based upon the actual data from Scandinavia, and certainly not the complete data, and he does not read Danish or Swedish or Norwegian like Darren Spadali does. And what he reported, we think inaccurately, is that same-sex marriage in Denmark, Norway, and Sweden actually had contributed to the end of marriage in all of those countries. And that argument that he made has been picked up not only by the right-wing talk radio, but by the leading conservatives who've been supporting the Marriage Protection Amendment in the Republican Party. Senator Rick Santorum, for example, Senator John Cornyn, Majority Leader Frist, former Majority Leader in the House, Tom DeLay, and then some of the more eminent intellectuals, such as former Judge Robert Bork, who actually was the drafter of the Marriage Protection Amendment. And they've all echoed his claim that the Scandinavian evidence actually proves that same-sex marriage will destroy marriage in a country, such as Denmark, Norway, and Sweden. And what our book, we think, very importantly does is it completely and thoroughly refutes the arguments that have been made by researcher Kurtz, by Judge Bork, by Senator Santorum, by Senator Frist, by former Representative DeLay, that these are completely fallacious arguments. And it shows that a lot of the opposition to same-sex marriage is not based upon a rational examination of the evidence.
And now, can you point out for us some of the benefits to society that same-sex marriage has brought to gays and lesbians? Because in your book, you talk about that society could benefit a lot from extending same-sex marriage benefits. And could you describe that a little bit for us?
Yes. One of the other things that the book does, and this occupies a great deal of it, and the book, by the way, is available for preview. It's on sale now, but it's available for preview at www.gaymarriagebook.com. It's easy to find. And what we do in the book is we've interviewed several dozen couples who've actually joined in registered partnerships since the statute in Denmark was passed. We've looked systematically at the public health and other data that Denmark has had, and we've also done a thorough examination of the statutes in these countries. And we've found that there are no costs to same-sex marriage of the sort that conservatives have been trumpeting in the United States. And indeed, there are different kinds of benefits. There are benefits at the level of the couples themselves. Many of the couples report that their own concept of their relationship changed after they joined in registered partnership, that they saw themselves as more publicly committed than they had been before. And this is, at least the couples we talked to, been reported as a very positive experience for them. And indeed, some of the couples reported that their straight friends who had been unmarried were inspired by their example actually to get married. Again, exactly contrary to what the conservatives with zero evidence have been saying in the United States. We also found that there were other society-wide benefits of same-sex unions in Scandinavia. At least theoretically, and in some cases, we've been able to demonstrate it through the use of systematic data. The most dramatic example of that is the rates of sexually transmitted diseases have dramatically declined in the Scandinavian countries since same-sex marriages have been recognized in Denmark in 1989. Now, this is at the same time that the rates have either stabilized or shown much more modest declines in other countries. So there have been more dramatic effects in Denmark, Sweden, and Norway, which had started off at a lower level anyway, because they had more effective sex education programs. So diseases such as gonorrhea, syphilis, and HIV or AIDS have actually fallen off. And in some cases, we've been able to demonstrate that they have fallen off for empirical reasons that cannot be linked to anything else except the one event, and that one event is the recognition of same-sex unions. It's actually impelling people to be more responsible in not transmitting sexually transmitted diseases, in being more monogamous, in practicing safer sex, and so on and so forth. And so that's a dramatic finding. There are other social findings, such as superior integration of gay and lesbian households into the larger society, into the community, into the workforce. And those, it seems to us, are also very considerable potential advantages for our culture.
Now, the Lutheran Church in Scandinavia has shown support for same-sex unions. On what principles do they rest for this? I mean, because, you know, the churches here have been very much against this. I mean, they've been, some of them have been at the forefront of the fight. So how do the churches in Scandinavia, particularly the Lutheran Church, kind of walk that line?
Well, like the churches, as you mentioned, in the United States, the main opposition to registered partnership in Denmark and these other countries has come through the Lutheran Church, although many Lutheran leaders, including many Lutheran priests, do favor the recognition of same-sex unions. At this point, the official church position is not in favor of that, and many priests will not perform these unions, and the official church does not quite recognize them in most of these countries. And they do it for some of the same reasons that American religious fundamentalists have opposed same-sex unions. They read the book of Genesis and other parts of the Bible as reflecting a biblical or scriptural basis for considering marriage, at least in the eyes of God, as exclusively a one-man, one-woman relationship.
Now, how can, you had mentioned the book was not out yet, but how can people get the book? Because the book is actually wonderful. I had gotten an advanced copy, and I really think it's something that should be, you know, on everybody's bookshelf.
Well, I think it is out in some bookstores. It's available, we think, on Amazon. And if you go to the website, the www.gaymarriagebook.com, there are links on the website to order the book either through Amazon or through Oxford University Press, which is the publisher. And we agree. We think it's a unique historical examination of the American debate and really the first book to systematically examine the evidence, exposing the unfactual basis of most of the conservative arguments that have been advanced thus far in the United States. So we think it's very important. It's unfortunately also important because it does suggest systematic reasons to think that in the United States, even in progressive parts of the United States, same-sex marriage will not come overnight.
No, and you know the bait, you know, it kind of keeps rearing its ugly head. The you know, the anti-marriage amendment, the constitutional amendment that keeps getting thrown out there every time the Republicans need to ramp up their core base. I mean, it comes over and over again. When we talked back in June, it had just reared its ugly head yet again. I don't think it's going away anytime soon, even with, you know, marriage being legal in Massachusetts with no adverse effects, to my knowledge.
Absolutely right. In fact, the issue in Massachusetts might even go to the voters in 2008, and we'll win in Massachusetts. The voters will agree in Massachusetts if it actually came to a vote, because all of the predictions of the naysayers have been falsified in Massachusetts as well. And indeed, a lot of the couples in Massachusetts are using the same-sex marriage option as a way to formalize relationships that are already either raising children or were planning to raise children. And it certainly has redounded to the benefit of the children in those in the state that has it. My state of Connecticut has civil unions, Vermont has civil unions, and other states are adopting recognition institutions that give many but not all of the same benefits and obligations of marriage. But there's still a very long way to go all the way across the United States.
And, you know, you can compare it, and you did in your book, to Loving versus Virginia, which was the Supreme Court decision that overturned the ban on interracial relationships or interracial marriages in this country. That decision was a long time coming, and I don't know when or if, you know, the rights of gay marriage are going to get to the Supreme Court.
Well, it took 100 years, almost exactly, for the issue of different race marriage to reach the U.S. Supreme Court after the adoption of the 14th Amendment, which we would interpret as making those bans unconstitutional. I believe, and Darren Spadali believes, that it's ultimately invalid for states to deny marriage rights to lesbian and gay couples. But it's quite clear that for a lot of the same reasons, the U.S. Supreme Court took a long time, and probably for good reason, to render different race marriage bans unconstitutional. It ought to take a long time, and probably not as long, before the U.S. Supreme Court will declare same-sex marriage bans unconstitutional. But I would not expect that anytime soon, and certainly not with the current personnel.
Well, William Eskridge, I want to thank you so much for being with us tonight. The book is called Gay Marriage, For Better or Worse, What We've Learned from the Evidence. I highly recommend it. It is fascinating, and it will definitely prepare you for those inevitable debates with right-wingers who are just determined to tell us that same-sex marriage cannot and will not work. William, thank you again. I appreciate your time, especially with all the little glitches we had the last time. And, you know, do keep us posted on your book.
Well, it is really my pleasure, and thank you for your excellent questions. I hope your readers or your listeners will read the book with as much insight as you did, Joan.
Great. Thank you so much. You're listening to Queer Voices.
A new survey about the so-called culture wars in the U.S. suggests that, with the exception of the combatants on opposing sides of each issue, there may not be much of a war at all. The results of the Pew Research Center's poll of 2003 American adults, conducted by phone in mid-July and released this week, concluded that, despite the high visibility of activist groups on both sides of the cultural divide, there has been no polarization of the public into liberal and conservative camps.
On five high-profile social issues, abortion rights, stem cell research, same-gender marriage, adoption of children by gay and lesbian couples, and the so-called morning-after pill to end a possible pregnancy, just 12% took the conservative position on all five issues, while only 22% consistently held the opposing view. The survey's margin of error was 2.5%. On specific lesbi-gay issues, 56% opposed giving same-gender partners the right to marry, but 53% supported a legal status that would provide many of the same rights as married couples. There's been a steady rise in U.S. public opinion in recent years, favoring some form of legal recognition for lesbian and gay couples.
There's also been an increase in the number of Americans who believe sexual orientation is innate, 36%, up from 30% in 2003. Nearly half, 49%, believe gays and lesbians cannot be converted to heterosexuality, compared with 42% who thought they could be in 2003.
In June, the Denver, Colorado-based Gill Foundation launched an online campaign at www.borndifferent.com and a series of 30-second TV spots featuring a cute animated puppy who communicates somewhat differently.
This is Norman. He's just like every other dog except for one thing. Norman never chose to be different. He was just born this way. Norman isn't the only one in the Springs born different. This is Dan. He's just like everyone else around town, except for one thing. He was born gay.
I don't know why.
Some scientists say
some people are born gay.
It turns out it's not just humans that are born gay. Animals are too. Is it likely that these animals chose to be gay? A percentage of the population is born gay too. You can't change the way you're born. If you disagree, ask yourself this one simple question. When did you choose to be straight?
Not everyone agrees with that point of view, of course, especially Focus on the Family, the Colorado Springs-based right-wing Christian empire. They insist that gays and lesbians need therapy to change their sexual orientation to become normal. In late July, the group launched a competing media campaign at no-moo-lies.com with a dog of its own.
This is Sherman. He's a dog. He barks. Why? Because that's what dogs do.
Focus hasn't revealed how much it's spending on its campaign, but Gill says it's allocated $900,000 for internet and TV ads. They've also mounted pictures of their mooing puppy on Colorado Springs city buses and on banners hanging on city light poles downtown.
The Rocky Mountain High city of Colorado Springs, a 2 hours drive from Denver, has a population of around 370,000. It was described in an article last year in Harper's Magazine as home to the greatest concentration of fundamentalist Christian activist groups in American history. Some city officials have questioned the use of city light poles for the Norman campaign and expressed concerns that such messages politicize city property and imply endorsement for the message.
In November, Coloradans may be asked to vote on up to three different state initiatives addressing same-gender marriage, civil unions, and domestic partnerships. Focus on the Family charges that the Gill Foundation's campaign is blatant electioneering. Gill says their mooing puppy is just an effort to get people talking about issues of sexual orientation, and they've apparently succeeded. Local reporter Eric Whitney hit the streets to gather a random sample of opinion in downtown Colorado Springs about the banners and the dueling doggy campaigns.
I think that it's been really thought-provoking. I think it's definitely served its purpose and that a lot of people are discussing it.
I don't really have an opinion about the issue. The banners are definitely in your face.
I think it's pretty cool. It's pretty different.
I have to agree, and I think there's nothing wrong with being different whatsoever. It's a good thing.
So you have an opinion about the dogs that say moo?
Yeah, I think that the homosexual movement was brilliant in their marketing.
Why do you say that?
Because they, you know, compare themselves to something adorable and endearing, and everybody likes a dog, and it says moo, and it's cute, so it makes everybody love it, and can't really hate a dog that moos, right?
I just think there's some ignorant people up there.
Ignorant people?
Focus on the Family. If they can't recognize that people are born that way, that nobody would absolutely choose to live that way. I can't believe that they're that ignorant to be that way and deliberately single out people to be oppressive towards.
You work downtown? Or
I do, yeah.
You hear people talking about it a lot? Or?
We've had some bad stuff about it, yeah. I mean, a lot of people don't like that it's, you know, right in their face, you know, that it's everywhere now.
Are people talking about it, do you think? Or?
Not that I've heard.
No, I don't think anybody really knows what it's about. I think they need to have more information on it.
So I spent 28 years of my life for defending the freedoms of the people around here in my military service, and if they want to do that, they have a right to do so. There shouldn't be one group trying to oppress another group from stop another group from doing that. They don't have that right.
Last we heard, Norman's banners were still flying. With thanks to Eric Whitney at KRCC-FM in Colorado Springs, Colorado, I'm Sherry Lund.
And I'm Tanya Kane Perry
for This Way Out.
This is Queer Voices.
Quinceañera honors a girl on her 15th birthday, but the new film by that name has already been honored with both the Audience Award and the Dramatic Grand Prize at this year's Sundance Film Festival. It's the love child of two out gay filmmakers who made it in their own multi-ethnic community using several neighbors in the cast. Quinceañera is getting rave reviews, not only for its depiction of traditional Latino families, but for putting a non-traditional family and gay character on the screen. This Way Out's Steve Pride learned more about the film from the movie makers next door.
The film, Quinceañera, is a look at what happens when teenage sexuality, age-old rituals, and real estate prices collide. As Magdalena's 15th birthday approaches, and she prepares for her quinceañera, her life takes an unexpected turn with the discovery that although she's technically a virgin, she's pregnant. Kicked out of her house, she finds a new family with her great-granduncle Tomas and her cousin Carlos, a tough gay cholo who was thrown out by his parents. The back house rental where Tomas has lived happily for many, many years is on a property that was recently purchased by an affluent white gay couple, pioneers of a gentrification, changing the traditionally poor and Latino makeup of their Echo Park neighborhood in Los Angeles.
Hello, I'm Wash Westmoreland.
And I am Richard Glatzer. We are the writer-directors of Quinceañera. We moved to Echo Park in 2001 and felt much more at home there than we had in the Melrose area where we were living previously. And got to know our neighbors very quickly and were asked to be the official photographers at our next-door neighbor's Quinceañera, which was our first real experience of that event. And just over time, we'd seen the neighborhood changing. We'd seen it gentrifying. And one day, it was January 1st, 2005, it just occurred to us, sitting around hungover, talking about ideas for movies we had, what an interesting kind of soup our block is. And just, you know, multi-ethnic, multicultural, different races, different sexuality, different generations, that it was such kind of ripe material. People right next door to each other and yet not knowing about each other's worlds.
Sylvia?
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen Carlos yet.
Well, he's not coming.
He's not coming to his own sister's quinceañera?
Aunt Sylvia, Uncle Walter wants you.
Don't talk to me about that boy.
Carlos, played by newcomer Jesse Garcia, is a gay character we've not seen in film before. A proud Latino, muscular and tattooed, outwardly a tough cholo, Carlos is also very comfortable with his sexuality. When he has a three-way with his white gay landlords, it blurs the lines of who's seducing who.
There's interesting gay issues in the movie that I don't think you've seen in films very much before. There's a couple of white gay guys in the movie. You know, the film is kind of critical of them. And I think it'd be kind of interesting for a gay audience to think about those issues, both in terms of the real estate and both in terms of, like, their attitude towards Carlos in the three-way. And I'd really like to provoke a discussion about those issues. But then, overwhelmingly, I think there's the story of Carlos, I think, resonates for a lot of gay people that, you know, he is ostracized from his family because of his sexuality, but he does find acceptance in a kind of queer family with a great granduncle who had never married but was this just kind of like mentor, this like parent that wasn't judgmental, and the effect that can have on, you know, on a gay person or any person like Magdalena who's experiencing a difference or like an ostracism, that, you know, to create that family and then to, for the main extended family to accept that family, I think that's just an extremely positive thing.
But issues of class, race, and power arise when Carlos has a separate affair with one of the two landlords.
Like this?
No, it's like this. This one's an E. This one's a P.
Echo Parque.
Echo Parque.
Be careful you don't flash everyone on Temple Street, though.
They're the rival gang, right? They'd kill you.
Wow.
You really live in a whole other world, don't you?
Nah.
You do.
I think it's a movie about acceptance, accepting things for the way they are, people for the way they are.
Actor Jesse Garcia.
He knew he was gay, but he allowed himself to be in that situation. If you don't want to be in that situation, you're not going to be in that situation. His dad found out that he was gay by internet sites that he was visiting. In media and movies, that's not how you find out. You either get caught with a dude or whatever, and his dad tracked a site that he went to. I mean, he knew he was gay, and he was, if you watch in the earlier scenes where they first meet, you know, you can kind of tell that Carlos is interested in just by looks, you know, when someone's interested and when someone's not. Most people do. I'm pretty oblivious, but...
How we think of Carlos isn't so much an archetype, but a new type. We think of him as a kid who has really got to know about sex and about sexual identity through the internet, which is something kids have only been really able to do, or people have only been able really to do since that technology's been around. But a lot of people do Google to find out the facts of life and the facts about themselves. So he's really formed a sexual identity that's quite solid about himself as a young gay man without ever coming into contact with physical gay people. So what you're seeing when in the movie, when he is like, you know, a young Latino guy comes into contact with a very white yuppie gay scene, is like a kind of culture clash within the gay community. He already knows he's gay, and in a way, in his relationships with James and Gary, he's a willing participant. He's playing the seduction game too. Ultimately, what happens with that story, though, brings up a lot of issues about a kind of codified racism in the white gay community. To see Carlos just as a plaything, as a kind of exotic sort of participant in the freeway, rather than giving him equal rights as a person, rather than like inviting him to the dinner party, they would just use him for sex. So it's really kind of looking at this attitude of like, well, what's behind that? And it's also asking sort of, you know, white gay community to question, what's it like from Carlos's point of view? What's it like for him?
One of the biggest surprises to many people is the background of the filmmakers behind Quinceañera. Richard Glatzer, who rode the queer new wave of the early 1990s with Grief, has been more recently involved in reality shows like America's Next Top Model. His partner, Wash Westmoreland, got his start directing gay porn titles that I can't say on the radio. Fans of Quinceañera at the video store looking for the last film they did together would be handed a copy of The Fluffer, about a gay kid with an unusual but necessary job in the gay porn industry.
Yeah, it's funny because it does feel like the movie has more mainstream appeal. Quinceañera definitely, and the reception's been amazing. We're so grateful. The Fluffer did divide people, but I feel both films have controversial elements in them. I mean, here we're dealing with teenage sexuality and with homophobia in the Latino community and a kind of coded racism in the gay community. So, you know, it's not like we've made a sugar-coated film or anything like that, but I'm so happy it's been received the way it is. It's a film about very different communities coming in contact with each other, and it's a film that's promoting tolerance. That's the way we see it.
This has been a conversation with Richard Glatzer, Wash Westmoreland, and Jesse Garcia. Quinceañera won both the Audience Award and the Dramatic Grand Jury Prize at this year's Sundance Film Festival. It's being released in the U.S. and the U.K. by Sony Pictures Classics. For more information, visit QuinceañeraTheMovie.com or PrideOnScreen.com. This is Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
Yo no sé por qué me siento hoy tan diferente, porque no quiero nada con la gente. ¿Qué será? Yo no sé por qué mi cuerpo cambia día con día.
Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. This week, Tanya Kane Perry, Sherry Lund, Rex Walkner, Bill Kelly, Graham Underhill, and Steve Pride contributed program material. Thanks also to Eric Whitney and KRCC-FM in Colorado Springs, and to Christopher David Trentum. You heard music from the Quinceañera soundtrack, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can listen online to This Way Out exclusively at outinamerica.com. Click on the features link on on their front page or use the link at the top of our website, thiswayout.org. Most This Way Out operating expenses are funded by direct charitable donations from our listeners. Thank you. Log on to thiswayout.org to see how you can help keep this program on the air and choose from some special LGBT movie, music, and history CD thank you gifts. To sign up for our weekly emailed program information messages and or our occasional This Way Out updates, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on 3BBB Ballarat, Victoria, KUNM Albuquerque, New Mexico, WCBN Ann Arbor, Michigan, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
This Way Out is heard every week as part of Queer Voices. You are listening to 90.1 FM KPFT.
And we're back. This is Jennifer Renee.
Elisar Saliba.
And Deborah Bell.
Yeah. Ellie, we were talking about Brenda Thomas the last segment where we had some time to talk, which was limited. You had something you wanted to say about Brenda?
Yeah. Actually, I ran into her just as I was really coming out in 1998.
Transgendered.
As transgendered.
Yes, of course.
And I hadn't figured out the rest.
They can't see us on the radio.
Really?
Well, you wouldn't necessarily be able to tell either on the.
That's very kind of you. Gosh,
kindness involved.
You're very
fact.
Sweet.
Well,
you were saying.
True, I am.
And I ran into her, the support group that she mentioned that she set up all those years ago, and I was like, I was confused. I was young. I was Arab, so I was like, okay, this is the worst. I am in the worst position in my life, and what am I going to do? And it was just kind of like she was just, you know, tough old broad who just inspired me, and she was like, I was like, wow, she's so cool, and I could do, I can probably do this, I can be like her, and you know, here I am on the radio because of this. I'm giving speeches. I am the, you know, almost token tranny girl of whatever campus I'm on or whatever group I am, except for this one, strangely enough. And you know, I've been told I make a lot of people just think differently about their perception of transgender people. We're not considered sex workers by the people I meet anymore, or just whatever, you know. I mean, it just she's inspired me to be out, be proud, and you know, sort of be an activist.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the growth of the community. And the way it's cleared, because so many times when you were transgendered and you came out, you couldn't get work. The only work available was survival sex was the only thing available to you. You were homeless. And now, due to society's changing ever so slightly, we can actually get jobs.
Well, Tim Brookover with Outsmart Magazine and the Community Center was on the Transgender Unity Committee. Is on the committee.
He is on the committee.
And he did a little write-up that he sent out via email where he highlighted some of Brenda's accomplishments. Why don't you share those with us, Jennifer?
Yes, I was going to, and I'm also secretary of the Houston Transgender Unity Committee. He was very complimentary of some of the things that he said, and let me just show you here. The transgender community, the Houston Transgender Unity Committee, and the gay, lesbian, bisexual transgender community lost a friend, a sister, and a champion when Brenda Thomas died on Sunday, and I think it was around 6:30 in the morning in Houston. Brenda, the executive director of the Unity Committee and a prominent transgender advocate, and HIV, AIDS, activist, and educator, was 63. Brenda left her community a far better place. Her contributions were numerous and significant. In addition to her volunteer work for years with the Houston Transgendered Unity Committee, Brenda served several other prominent local transgendered organizations. She founded the group Helping Transgenders Anonymous and was a past facilitator of the local Tai Chi chapter of Tri-S, the Society for the Second Self. Brenda was also editor of the Tai Chi magazine. Through her personal website, which she maintained up until recently when she fell ill, Brenda helped educate countless individuals seeking information on transgendered issues. And in 2002, Brenda received the Lifetime Achievement Award at the annual Houston Transgender Unity Committee banquet. At the same time, she received a proclamation from the mayor declaring it Brenda Thomas Day. In 2004, the International Foundation for Gender Education presented Brenda with a prestigious Trinity Award, which honors transgendered heroes. In 2005, she was named one of the co-chairs of the U.S. Conference on AIDS, which was to be held in Houston until the threat of Hurricane Rita caused it to be canceled. The same year, Outsmart magazine named Brenda one of the people to watch for 2005. Brenda worked for the City of Houston in the Bureau of HIV-STP Prevention as the coordinator of transgender services. Brenda was frequently asked to speak to groups about transgender and HIV issues. These groups, as well as her many friends, valued Brenda for her candor and her wit. As her friend and fellow transgender advocate Kristen Williams wrote for Outsmart in 2001, Brenda Thomas shoots from the hip. Her entire demeanor suggests seniority. She has been there, bought the t-shirt, worn it, thrown it away, and has already bought the new one. Brenda is survived by her mother, Sunny Ratiff, of Salem, Oregon, and her daughter, Jennifer Rainier, who lives in Houston, and many other friends and loved ones in the community. Brenda was born in Spokane, Washington. Plans for the memorial service are currently pending. I understand it's going to be sometime next week, but we'll let you know if we can. For those wishing to make remembrance, Brenda has asked that in lieu of flowers, individuals contribute to the Peggy Rudd Transgender Scholarship Fund. The program is administered by the Houston Transgender Unity Committee that awards college scholarships to transgendered students. The address is HTUC, Post Office Box 542287, Houston, Texas 77254. And additional information on the Peggy Rudd Transgender Scholarship Fund is available at the website www.HoustonTransgenderUnity.org. Any other information, you can contact Melody Rudd directly at MelPeg@mindspring.com. Bless her heart.
Yes, and thank you, Brenda, for all that you did, and fairly well.
Well, she helped me to become the woman I am today, and yeah. I, you know,
you and many
thanks.
Others apparently.
Oh yes, yeah. many
of them. And so you carry
at least
on.
One of them was a wife of mine.
Yeah, and you carry on. You know, she passed the torch.
Exactly. So. And there are people out there in the community today that will, you know, pick up that torch and go with it. You know, it's a shame when we lose the good ones, and it's, you know, and you say that the good ones always die young. For us, the ones that are left, it gives us time to become good.
Well, a lot of the work that Brenda did was over at Baring Memorial, and Baring and Friends is going to be taking place this Friday and Saturday, and I think Ellie has an announcement.
Yeah.
Baring and Friends is putting on a production of Once Upon a Time this Friday. That's August 11th and 12th, and it's a fundraising event benefiting the Baring Support Network. But they need volunteers. They need stagehands, ushers, somebody to help set up and break down the silent auction, and somebody to hang out and do the tickets. Anybody who's interested can contact them at 713-526-1018. That's 713-526-1018. And of course, going out and volunteering in your community is a great way to help people, as Brenda would, and of course, if you're interested, meet interesting and beautiful people.
And one of the things about
some of them, right?
Volunteering for Baring and Friends is that you get to see the show, so you get to have fun and you know, yeah. as you give something. Well, we have to say thanks to our guest tonight.
Yes, thank you, David Elliott from Washington, D.C. David joins us every Monday of every month and Inside the Beltway and Beyond Report. Allison Bechtel, and we had our special guest interviewer, Pokey Anderson, author's William Eskridge, who discussed her book on gay marriage for better or for worse, what we've learned from the evidence, and the folks who produced This Way Out at KPFT in...
KPFA.
KPFA, excuse me, in Los Angeles.
Join us next Monday on Queer Voices for Tony Pryor, who will talk about his workshop called Joyful Singing 101, which is about using singing to find your voice.
Was doing that earlier.
Yes. The Bayou City Women's Chorus will talk about their latest recruitment efforts. And Jeff Reed from the Houston Equal Rights Alliance will bring us the latest on current political happenings and items of interest. Plus, folks from the GLBT Community Center will talk about the latest on queer bingo.
It's fun. Come see it.
Thanks for being with us tonight.
You have been listening to Queer Voices, heard each Monday at 8 p.m. here on KPFT, a publicly funded Pacifica Network station. Queer Voices is produced live in Houston with recorded segments from This Way Out, which is produced at KPFK in Los Angeles. Queer Voices executive producer is Jack Valensky. On-air voices are Glenn Holt, J.D. Doyle, Deborah Bell, Jennifer Renee, Greg Chapman, and Jack Valensky. Be sure to listen every Saturday night, Sunday morning at 1 a.m. for After Hours with Jimmy Carper. It's Queer Radio with Attitude. This is listener-sponsored and commercial-free Pacifica Radio, KPFT, at 90.1 FM, 89.5 FM Galveston, and worldwide via streaming audio from kpft.org. For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
KPFT's fall concert series is coming up this September and October, and we are looking for musicians to fill spots in six different genres.
The genres are world music, Zydeco Cajun, Roots Americana, Indie Rock, turntables to turntablas, and hip-hop.
So if you are a civic-minded artist looking for local exposure, this is your opportunity. Send a copy of your original music on a CD along with the photo, bio, and any other information you would like us to have to www.kpft.org.
Please note that no artist will benefit financially from this event. The concert series is free to all who attend.
Again, those genres are world music, Zydeco Cajun, Roots Americana, Indie Rock, turntables to turntablas, and hip-hop.
Visit www.kpft.org for more information.
And help KPFT encompass Houston's multicultural, multigenerational, and musical diversity.
This is KPFT Houston, Radio for Peace.
This is Callie with the KPFT Building Collective. We have been working to make listener-sponsored KPFT look and function better and be more accessible for everyone. Our projects have included an access ramp into the station, an ADA-compliant restroom, handrails in and outside the station, and we are gradually landscaping the grounds. The carpet in the lobby and conference room is torn and worn and is in need of replacement, so we're looking for someone to donate enough carpet for two rooms. We are looking for dark, commercial-grade carpet and volunteer carpet layers who can help us with this project. Call 713-526-4000. In addition to carpet, our roof is leaking and we need qualified roofers to help repair or replace our roof. If you would like to help KPFT, call 713-526-4000.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.